Greetings. It's September 9th, 2025, and this is the Arizona Daily Star brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant. On the front page, rainwater harvesting growing in Southwest. The key is to collect every drop of it. Collecting rain is widespread in many of the Earth's driest regions. This is from Anita Snow, Associated Press. Home gardeners and landscapers in the U.S. Southwest and beyond are turning more to collecting rainwater amid worsening drought and rising temperatures fueled by global warming. Nothing makes Tucson and Brad Lancaster happier than a monsoon downpour. The tall 58-year-old jumped like a kid in the puddles on the sidewalk one recent August afternoon after half an inch of rain suddenly fell during an especially dry summer. Sweet! Lancaster exclaimed, beaming when he saw how the water pooled in a basin he had dug earlier in a dirt planted with native vegetation along the public walkway. It's really important that you are ready to plant the rain when it comes. Even if it's just a small amount, he said, referring to the simple type of rainwater harvesting that involves digging a hole to allow rainwater to sink underground and be held like a sponge. The key is to collect every drop of it. Lancaster and other rainwater harvesting specialists say that home gardeners anywhere can benefit from collecting raindrops and runoff from buildings and other surfaces to irrigate plants, even in wetter regions where the practice is less common. Rainwater collecting is widespread in many of the Earth's driest regions. In Australia, it's often used for drinking water, bathing, and flushing toilets. And in Africa, where Lancaster said he learned more about the practice, it helps communities survive. Saving the rain is also useful in southern Arizona, which is under pressure from a long-running drought. It's drier than ever, and with Tucson receiving less than half of the 7 inches of rain that it usually sees by the first week of September. Some of the heaviest rainfalls in Arizona and other parts of the U.S. Southwest occur in the summer, during the annual North American monsoon season. As much as two-thirds of residential water in the desert city is used outdoors, said Adriana Zuniga, an associate research professor in the Environmental Policy Program at University of Arizona. The idea is to use less water from the tap to irrigate, she said, and rainwater is by no means a modern revolution. Zuniga, who has researched water use of the Mayan people who had lived in what is now Central America and southeastern Mexico, noted that the ancient civilization captured rainwater to help to survive dry, hot summers. It should be fundamental to how we live in the Southwest and ultimately everywhere in the coming years in the face of climate change, said Tucsonan landscaper Eli Nielsen, who co-owns a store that sells rainwater harvesting products, including rain chains that guide water from a top building. Looking to create a rain collection system of your own? Here's how to start. First, educate yourself. Find out if your state has restrictions on rainwater harvesting or requires a permit due to environmental or health or safety considerations. A tool created by the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in collaboration with the Federal Energy Management Program System can help. See if your city or county water department has a program that encourages rainwater harvesting or has other resources. Your local community college and cooperative extension office may also have educational programs offering guidance. In the case of Tucson, the city water department offers rebates up to $2,000 for a residential rain collection system. It works with a local nonprofit watershed management group to provide free 2-hour classes that residents must take to design a collection system that qualifies for a rebate. One class anyone can attend virtually is the Essential Rainwater Course, offered for free on YouTube. It's co-hosted by Water Harvesting Authority Peter Combs, a honorary professor at the Australian National University and managing director of the independent think tank Urban Water Cycle Solutions, and Michelle Avis, co-founder of the Canadian organization Verge Permaculture. Many proponents of collecting precipitation say that the most authoritative book on the subject is Lancaster's Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond. Along with a second volume published later, Lancaster also offers free resources to the public on his website. 2. Make a plan. Decide how ambitious you want to be. Few people are going to be as dedicated to collecting the rain as Lancaster, said Xin Yi Chang, an assistant research professor in hydrology and atmospheric sciences at the University of Arizona. She gives Lancaster credit for the practice's popularity in Tucson. Active harvesting systems use storage tanks, pipes, and sometimes pumps. But similar passive systems are low-tech and work by shaping the landscape with basins and other contours alongside trees and other foliage. This allows the rainwater to gather, then sink underground to recharge aquifers and nourish thirsty plants nearby. It's very easy to get started with contouring, Chang said, noting that the active systems can be more expensive to set up and maintain. 3. Looking for help? If you need assistance, consider hiring a landscaper with experience in harvesting systems. You can also seek out master gardeners at local nurseries or home improvement stores. And you can look to Lancaster for inspiration, tapping into the joy he expresses every time the rain falls. Ice poses challenges for Chicago. This is from Christine Fernando and Claudia Lauer of the Associated Press. Chicago. As President Donald Trump expanded immigration raids and threatened to deploy the National Guard, Chicago has become the latest flashpoint in a broader national struggle over how far the federal government can push local authorities to cooperate in its immigration agenda. The Department of Homeland Security said Monday on social media that Operation Midway Blitz was underway. For the Chicago Police Department, the challenge is acute. The force must preserve public safety in a city already under strain while avoiding the appearance of working hand-in-hand with the federal immigration authorities, a stance that could erode community trust and ignite new protests. The same balancing act has confronted other big city departments in recent months. Local police in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. were drawn into fraught arrangements with federal agencies that experts say left residents wary and at times undermined public confidence in their office. Chicago finds itself on the same path, with Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker objecting to any National Guard deployment and city officials bracing for how the added federal presence could reshape the dynamic on the ground. The outcome, policing experts warn, could determine whether Chicago police can maintain credibility in immigrant communities likely to be targeted by a president determined to show force. What the Trump administration is doing here is engaging in federal policing in a way that really rips at the seams of the relationships between state and local police and the federal government, between communities and law enforcement, said Naina Gupta, policy director at American Immigration Council. Those kinds of standoffs and contentious practices is what erodes public safety. Sanctuary city conflicts. Over the course of the Trump administration's immigration surges, Chicago officials repeatedly reaffirmed the city's so-called sanctuary policies that have been in place for 4 decades. But as fear grew about looming U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement actions, the city's mayor has avoided detail about how local police will navigate tensions on the ground. Chicago's policies bar local law enforcement from asking about or detaining anyone for their immigration status or from supporting ICE, including by securing perimeter for raids, transporting detainees, or sharing information about undocumented immigrants. Mayor Brandon Johnson signed an executive order last week declaring city police would not collaborate with federal immigration agents. It also requires Chicago officers to wear uniforms and not wear masks to clearly distinguish them from federal agents. We will not have our police officers who are working hard every single day to drive down crime deputized to do traffic stops and checkpoints for the president, Johnson said before signing the order. Greg Futterman, A law professor at the University of Chicago said, any cooperation between ICE and local officers hurts public trust and blurs the lines between agencies. It can get really messy, Futterman said. And that's how sanctuary cities are supposed to work on paper versus what's happening in practice. Protesters and ICE. Gupta said Chicago police will have to coordinate with federal agencies to some degree and even respond to protests against immigration raids and detentions. In the meantime, city officials say they are following a similar strategy to policing as the one in place around the 2024 Democratic National Convention, which cost the city about $27 million in officer overtime. ICE detained at least 10 Chicagoans at an immigration office on June 4th, drawing dozens of protesters and local elected officials to the street outside. Some protesters and local elected officials claim they saw Chicago officers clearing the way for ICE agencies and protecting their vehicles. Chicago City Council members demanded an internal probe into officers' behavior. Similar tensions played out in California, where hundreds of protesters clashed with federal immigration authorities in June, prompting Trump to deploy thousands of National Guard troops to Los Angeles, despite the objections of local authorities. Los Angeles police made hundreds of arrests and dispersed demonstrations, including at locations where ICE agents conducted raids. Turning to national and world news, Epstein investigation. Democrats release letter. Trump denies signing suggestive birthday greeting to former pal. This is from Michelle L. Price, Associated Press. Washington. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee released a sexually suggestive letter to Jeffrey Epstein on Monday, purportedly signed by President Donald Trump, which he denies. Trump claims he didn't write the letter or create the drawing of a curvaceous woman that surrounds the letter. He also filed a $10 billion lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal for a report on the alleged letter. The letter was included as part of a 2003 album compiled for sex trafficker Epstein's birthday. The president denies having anything to do with it. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee received a copy of the birthday album on Monday as part of a batch of documents from Epstein's estate. The White House did not immediately respond to a message seeking comment. After the letter was released, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Taylor Budowich posted pictures on social media of Trump's signature and tagged the Wall Street Journal's parent corporation News Corp, writing, "Time for an at News Corp to open that checkbook. It's not his signature. Defamation, all caps. These are not my words, not the way I talk, and I don't draw pictures," Trump previously said. The letter released by the committee looks exactly as described by the Wall Street Journal in its report. The letter bearing Trump's name and signature includes a text framed by a hand-drawn outline of what appears to be a curvaceous woman. "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret," the letter says. The letter's disclosure comes amid a bipartisan push in Congress for the release of the so-called Epstein files, amid years of speculation and conspiracy theories. Calls for the release of the records came from the Republicans, including Vice President J.D. Vance, before he was sworn into the country's number two position. Epstein, a wealthy and well-connected financier, killed himself in a Manhattan jail while awaiting trial in 2019 on charges that he had sexually abused and trafficked dozens of underage girls. The case was brought more than a decade after he secretly cut a deal with federal prosecutors in Florida to dispose of nearly identical allegations. Epstein was accused of paying underage girls hundreds of dollars in cash for messages and then massages, then molesting them. Trump's ties to Epstein are well documented, though he said they had a falling out over two decades ago. Chief Justice lets Trump fire member of the FTC. Roberts' ruling allows commissioner's lawsuit to play out in court. Associated Press. Washington. Chief Justice John Roberts on Monday let President Donald Trump remove a member of the Federal Trade Commission, the latest in a string of high-profile firings permitted by the Supreme Court. Trump first moved to fire Rebecca Slaughter in the spring, but she sued and lower courts ordered her reinstated because the law allows commissioners to be removed only for problems like misconduct or neglect of duty. Roberts halted those decisions in a brief order, responding to an appeal from the Trump administration. The Justice Department argued that the FTC and other executive branch agencies are under Trump's control, and the Republican president is free to remove commissioners without cause. Slaughter's lawsuit over her firing will keep playing out as Roberts asked her lawyers to respond to the Trump administration's arguments by next week. The court previously allowed the firings of several other board members of independent agencies. It suggested, however, that his power to fire has limitations at the Federal Reserve, a prospect that could soon be tested in the case of Federal Governor Lisa Cook. Immigration. South Koreans feel betrayed after raid. Authorities arrested hundreds of workers at a Georgia Hyundai plant. This is from Hung Jin Kim and Kim Tong Hung of Associated Press, Seoul, South Korea. South Korea's foreign minister departed for the U.S. on Monday to finalize steps for the return of several hundred South Korean workers detained in a massive immigration raid in Georgia, a spectacle that caused confusion, shock, and a sense of betrayal among many in the U.S. allied nation. The September 4th raid on a battery factory under construction at the sprawling Hyundai auto plant resulted in the detainment of 475 workers, more than 300 of them South Koreans. Some were shown being shackled with chains around their hands, ankles, and waists in a video released by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. South Korea announced Sunday that the U.S. agreed to release them and that it would bring them home on a charter flight once final administration state of steps are completed. President Donald Trump said the workers were here illegally and that, instead, the U.S. needs to work out arrangements with countries like South Korea to bring their experts in to train U.S. citizens. U.S. Homeland Security Kristi Noem said Monday she doesn't think the detentions will deter investment in the U.S. This is a great opportunity for us to make sure that all countries are reassured that when you come to the United States, you know what the rules of the game are, Noem said in a meeting in London of ministers from an intelligence-sharing partnership focused on border security. Appearing at a legislative hearing before his departure, Foreign Minister Cho Hyun called the raid a very serious matter, but he didn't anticipate, as many lawmakers lamented in the American operation. If U.S. authorities detain hundreds of Koreans in this manner, almost like a military operations, how can South Korean companies investing in the U.S. continue to invest properly in the future? Said Cho Jung-sik, a lawmaker from the liberal governing Democratic Party. Another lawmaker, Kim Ji-hyun, from the conservative opposition People Power Party, said the unacceptable raid dealt South Korea a severe blow that will be difficult to heal. Some lawmakers even called for the government to retaliate by investigating Americans who are alleged to work illegally in South Korea. And in the News Digest, Israel destroys another high-rise in Gaza City, Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. Israel struck and destroyed another high-rise building Monday in Gaza City after warning residents to evacuate, part of an offensive aimed at taking over the largest Palestinian city. The military claimed it targeted Hamas observation posts and bombs placed around the 12-story office building. U.S. President Donald Trump said he was giving his last warning to Hamas regarding a possible ceasefire, as Arab officials described a new U.S. proposal for the immediate release of all the remaining hostages in exchange for 3,000 Palestinian prisoners and a temporary ceasefire. Also on Monday, Palestinian attackers opened fire on a bus stop during the morning rush hour in Jerusalem, killing 6 people and wounding 12, according to Israeli officials. And now we're coming up to 20 minutes past the hour. Let's continue with the digest. Trump wants High Court to keep foreign aid frozen. Washington. The Trump administration asked the Supreme Court on Monday for an emergency order to keep billions of dollars in foreign aid frozen. The crux of the legal fight is over nearly $5 billion in congressionally approved aid that President Donald Trump said last month he would not spend, invoking disputed authority that was last used by a president about 50 years ago. Doesn't say which president that was. Last week, U.S. District Judge Amir Ali ruled that the Republican administration's decision to go to withhold the funding was likely illegal. Trump told House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican of Louisiana, in a letter August 28th that he would not spend $4.9 billion in congressionally approved foreign aid, effectively cutting the budget without having to go through the legislative branch. Briefly, Ukraine war. Senior Ukrainian officials led 60 foreign diplomats on a tour of damaged government offices Monday in the heart of Kiev, a day after Russia's largest aerial attack on Ukraine since its all-out invasion began more than 3 years ago. Nepal protests. Police in Nepal's capital of Kathmandu opened fire Monday on demonstrators protesting a government attempt to regulate social media that blocks some of the world's largest platforms, including Facebook, X, and YouTube. Authorities killed at least 17 people. France. Legislatures toppled France's government in a confidence vote Monday, a new crisis for Europe's second-largest economy that obliges President Emmanuel Macron to search for a fourth prime minister in 12 months. Prime Minister François Bayrou was ousted in a 364-194 vote against him. Lebanon. Israel launched airstrikes Monday on the outskirts of northeastern Lebanon, killing 5 people, including 4 Hezbollah members, according to officials. This comes as global pressure mounts to disarm the Lebanese militant group. Mexico. A freight train slammed into a double-decker bus early Monday at the crossing point northwest of Mexico City, killing at least 10 people and injuring more than 40, authorities said. The crash took place in an industrial area in the town of Alta Cumulco. Serbia. Thousands of student-led protesters chanted slogans against Serbia's president Aleksandar Vučić at a rally Monday in downtown Belgrade, accusing the police of brutality during a recent anti-government demonstrations that have shaken his populist rule. And this is from the Associated Press. Florida Springs face threats. This is from Kurt Anderson, Marta Lavandier, and Daniel Kozin of the Associated Press. Zephyr Hills, Florida. Seen from the air, a Florida freshwater spring is a bit of liquid heaven, luring humans and wildlife to enjoy its aquamarine cool. With at least 1,000 of them, more than any other state, the springs serve as beaches for large swaths of central and northwestern Florida, far from the ocean, with teenagers backflipping from docks and snorkelers peering into the crystalline depths. These treasures are under threat from agricultural pollution, rapid development, and climate change. Some places, such as fast-growing Zephyr Hills in west central Florida, pause some construction as it struggles to stay within the limits of the drinking water it can withdraw from a vast underground aquifer. Zephyr Hills is home to Crystal Springs, the source of bottled water named after the town and several other brands. Covering an estimated 100,000 square miles, the underground Florida aquifer is the source of 90% of Florida's drinking water. Because of the porous nature of the state's bedrocks, millions of gallons of water find their way to the surface in the form of clear, clean springs that in turn feed into rivers. The highest concentration of springs are in central and northern Florida, including most of the 30 first magnitude springs, those that discharge at least 65 million gallons of water every day. All but four are now considered polluted. We just have too much pollution going into the ground and too much water coming out of the ground, said Ryan Smart, executive director of the nonprofit Florida Springs Council. And when you get that combination, you end up with springs that are no longer blue and vibrant and full of life. In rural Florida, runoff from fertilizers and pesticides used in farm fields is a major part of the problem. Fertilizers containing phosphates and nitrogen to promote algae blooms that can suffocate a spring. Livestock waste contributes too. When that algae covers everything, then you lose all the seagrasses. And the seagrasses are the forests of the water, Smart said. Then you begin to lose the biodiversity, and it even puts our drinking water at risk. Elsewhere in Florida, rampant development is the threat. With more than 1,000 people moving to Florida every day, more housing subdivisions are sprouting, along with the roads, strip malls, restaurants, golf courses, and everything else that comes with them. That means more paved surfaces that keep rainwater from percolating down into the aquifer and more pollutant-laden runoff from lawn fertilizers, parking lots, and ever-widening roads, and sometimes septic tanks. That also means that more and more people, many of them whom enjoy tubing, paddleboarding, kayaking, and swimming in the springs. It gets so busy in the summer at some springs in the state and local parks that entry is halted by late morning. At Itchituckney Springs State Park, north of Gainesville, the daily limit of 750 tubers on the upper river is often reached within an hour after the park opens. Dennis Jones, a Republican former legislator, said that the volume of permits issued for water isn't sustainable. You cannot keep taking water out of the aquifer because it's not an endless supply, he said. Phosphate mining also took a toll. Their operations require a great deal of water, which reduces water pressure available for springs. Some died almost completely from mining and other factors, including White Sulphur Springs in northern Florida, which was a sacred place for Native Americans and later a tourist resort that attracted famous visitors such as Henry Ford and Theodore Roosevelt. A more subtle threat to the health of springs involves Earth's changing climate. It's altering rainfall patterns around the globe, threatening the balance that feeds Florida's springs. In addition, some springs along the coast face an intrusion of salt water, according to the Southwest Florida Water Management District. Four major springs are becoming increasingly brackish because of the sea level rise and declining rainwater. As a result, freshwater vegetation has a hard time surviving in this saltier environment, and unwanted vegetation moves in, the district said in a website post. Florida spends billions every year on water quality projects, including $800 million this year for Everglades restoration work. State funding for springs runs about $50 million a year, according to state documents. Two state efforts at improving the spring's quality, both about a decade old, remain bottled up in court and administrative challenges. One would strengthen the rules that for permits to draw water from the major springs. The other would enhance rules to reduce the amount of nutrients, such as nitrogen and phosphates, that can go into springs that are considered impaired. Jones said lobbying by powerful agricultural interests and related political pressures blocked progress on the nitrogen reduction plan that was expected to take about 20 years. We got more nitrates now than when we started, he said. In Congress, U.S. Representative Randy Fine recently filed a bill that would create the Florida Springs National Park across several counties centered around the Ocala National Forest. Fine said the designation would protect the springs and increase funding. It cost bottling companies just $115 for a permit, allowing them to withdraw millions of gallons of water in perpetuity, though they pay local taxes. Blue Triton, the company that bottles Zephyr Hills water, pays about $600,000 a year in taxes for things like schools, public safety, and so forth, said Stephen Spina, a member of the city council. Michelle Jameson loves the springs, and she grew up swimming in one of the in one and is determined to help protect them. She volunteers for Springs Watch Citizen Science Program, coordinating and working with other volunteers for monthly tests on Waukeva River, north of Orlando. And now let's turn to Tucson and regional news. Budget cuts put garden, kitchen, and others at risk. This is from Clara Migoya of the Arizona Republic. At the corner of East 32nd Street and 4th Avenue, fruit trees reach into the sidewalk and garden beds grow lush. Neighbors changed the fate of that property when 14 years ago they got together to prevent a motorcycle gang club from purchasing the land and asked the city to invest in healthy living programs instead. The county bought the property and leased it to Garden Kitchen, a community health program run by the University of Arizona, which has since offered a variety of free programs aimed at promoting overall health through cooking and physical activities classes, gardening days, and nutrition training for kids, early childhood teachers, and parents. That work is now at a crossroads after the federal grant that funded the Garden Kitchen and its staff was terminated by President Donald Trump in his Budget Reconciliation Act. The Garden Kitchen staff is funded by SNAP-ED dollars, just like some 170 public health educators, nutrition specialists, and community workers across Arizona's 15 counties. Those working under federally funded programs promote healthy lifestyles, help families learn how to eat better on a tight budget, and partner with institutions to make changes that can make healthy choices easier. For every dollar invested in SNAP Ed, $7 to $10 is saved on health care costs, studies show. They don't say what the studies were, though. Critics say that the decision to eliminate it is counterintuitive to the administration's so-called Make American Healthy Again campaign. SNAP, previously known as the food stamps programs, was hit with budget cuts under the Trump bill, but under the Trump bill, SNAP Ed, short for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Education, will end September 30th. In Arizona, the 33-year-old program was branded under the name AZ Health Zone and received $15 million a year. It's not about a garden. It's about these people who make a difference in the community, said Jen Parlin, director of the Garden Kitchen, about the pain of losing a cornerstone program for community health. Staffers help sustain school gardens, provide cooking demonstrations to parents, and teach nutrition principles. But they also have worked to create new bike paths, reopen forgotten city parks, change school menus, and increase outside time. Through the years, SNAP Ed has moved away from being a finger-wagging health education program, Parlin said. Traditionally focused on obesity prevention, the work now strives for overall health and engages with families and local government to make infrastructure and policy changes that can make healthy choices easier. At schools, with cafeterias at preschools, out at community gardens, with farmers at farmers markets, they're just quietly there in the communities, providing this education and support that not a lot of people know about, said Adrienne Udarbe, CEO of Pinnacle Prevention, an Arizona nonprofit that provides training to SNAP Ed staffers. Without them, we don't have anybody else who's going to do this at a statewide level. About 400 across the state were involved in SNAP Ed in some ways, according to the University of Arizona, which staffs and runs the program in 12 counties. The biggest collaborations were between the university's cooperative extension, the Arizona Department of Health, and county health departments. The Garden Kitchen will stay in the South Tucson property for at least two more years under the current lease, but will lose over half its staff, and weekly work with early childhood centers and senior centers will end by October, said Parlin. Due to the lack of funding, they will have to downscale from 35 partnerships to fewer than 10. Parlin said they've sought new grants and donors to keep more programs running, but the competition is high right now due to the widespread federal cuts. We will see, she said. There's a big pool of people who need a small pot of money. Community staple. Ed Beltran likes to call himself a product of the Garden Kitchen. He's now a staffer with the University of Arizona program. He's a lifelong resident of South Tucson and a former correctional officer for juveniles who got involved with the project after came to the neighborhood in late 2012. He became an employee in 2020. The Garden Kitchen helped him improve his eating habits and increase time he spent outside, he said. He sought advice from them when he was building a garden in the correction center, and later helped early childhood centers build their own. Now he and his wife are building a community garden in their own backyard. Although still unfinished, the shared space has drawn in neighbors and helped them open up to one another. The reason I started was because of trauma, said Beltran, referring to his own scars with post-traumatic stress disorder and the needs of community for safe spaces. Gardening is an outlet, he said. A lot of men come in, hanging out and helping me out, but they're talking. Working with the Garden Kitchen, Beltran says, provides the seeds, soil, and know-how to build up the Pascua Yaqui Tribe Head Start Butterfly Garden. The space offers the first exposure to language and agrarian heritage for kids aged 3 to 5, said David Jimes, a staff member with the school and the garden keeper. They learn Yaome words for the crops and bury in the soil seeds of gourd, squash, corn, and beans. Before a morning of learning in the garden and before crossing the butterfly arch, glimmering with metal, mosaic, and glass figurines, the children would read together, Su tut tui tawai. What a beautiful day. The programs also are adjusted to fit parents' realities. Some cooking programs happen remotely, so working moms and dads can take lessons in the evenings. Staffers deliver the ingredients and then host classes over Zoom for the family. Trying new things can be scary for families who can't afford to make any mistakes and waste food, said Veronica Vialbe, a community outreach assistant with the Garden Kitchen. We're giving them ways to try the food without a burden to their wallet. Staff members are trauma-informed, Vialbe said, and they work with teachers to look into students' behavior and nutrition from a broader angle. Why is this child a picky eater? Why is mealtime hard for some children? In Beltran's neighborhood, drug dealing and gang violence are constant threats. Immigration raids and unannounced military training within the 1.2 square mile city has set many residents on the edge. Over the years, a lot of projects have come to South Tucson with good intentions, Beltran said, but they come and they go. The Garden Kitchen was permanently here, and it was a staple, he added. I got involved because it's in the neighborhood. He recalled how the pocket park near his house was fenced off and closed for years until Parlin and community partners got involved with the city to see how they could recover green spaces. To open up a park, that's really big. What comes next for the kitchen? The end of September will mark the last day of work for dozens of community outreach workers across Arizona. The Garden Kitchen will only be able to retain 3 staff members. Programs will shrink and change, although Parlin says they will continue to working on areas like gardening and nutrition education. Of the over 170 people whose work was funded by SNAP Ed, some will be relocated to similar programs, but most will face job loss. Some 29 positions at the Arizona Department of Health Services will be affected. Arizonans will lose a comprehensive statewide program that works alongside communities to navigate systems, improve access to nutritious food, and create safe opportunities for physical activity, an agency spokesperson wrote to the Republic. Individual partners across Arizona will continue to provide services that are vital for families, but without the connecting infrastructure and trusted relationships, that the AZ Health Zone provided. It's a scary future because of those SNAP Ed practitioners had been embedded in the communities for the past 30 years, said Udarbe with the Pinnacle Prevention. Each county will receive a small amount of state funding beginning this winter to help selected programs and projects either phase out partnerships or buy time to find new funding sources where possible. The Summer Food Service Program, which offers free nutritious meals to children when school isn't in session and is administered by the Arizona Department of Education, will continue. So will the Garden Kitchens Plaza, promoting local AZ agriculture, a weekly mobile market which sells locally grown produce at a discounted prices outside the Valencia and Quincy Douglas libraries. For the loss of other services, the effects are hard to quantify. The thing about prevention is that you don't see the effects of it being gone until it's gone, said Parlin, who has worked nearly 15 years in South Tucson. It's just like the weather service layoffs, she said. The effects are not obvious until a disaster comes. People tell us anecdotally that they've changed their diets, how their family has become more connected, and how they're cooking with their kids, she said. That's all prevention. If that wasn't happening, it could have gnarly effects that you didn't see because we were there. That's about 19 minutes before the hour. Eco-friendly winery building community in Patagonia. This is from Sarah Lapidus of the Arizona Republic. Just a handful of miles away from the heart of southern Arizona's wine region lies an eco-friendly winery and tasting room working to build community in one of the region's small rural towns. Queen of Cups, located down an alley off the main road in Patagonia, uses low-intervention methods and sustainable practices. The three-year-old business believes wine is for everyone and aims to make it accessible. Wine doesn't have to be this fancy thing that you only drink on your birthday. You can come down to the winery and have a glass casually, meet up with your friends casually, said Lily Christopher, one of the winery's founders. We're just trying to bring things a little bit down to earth. Located outside of Arizona's two American viticulture areas, Willcox and Sonoyta, Queen of Cups has expanded the industry's footprint in southern Arizona. It's based in Patagonia, a 900-person town just a 15-minute drive from Sonoyta, nestled in the foothills between the Patagonia Mountains and the Santa Rita Mountains. Christopher and Emmett Ron Oakes first met in Patagonia, eventually moving to Spain, where the couple's dream to open a winery began. We were really inspired by some of the village wineries that were using pretty small spaces to accomplish a great deal as far as production and atmosphere goes, Christopher said. Homemade Spanish wine sparks a dream. In Galicia, Spain, Ron Oakes worked making wine and Christopher taught English. After one particular delicious meal with multiple courses and homemade wine served in plastic water bottles, the dream to open their own winery was born. When the couple first opened Queen of Cups in July 2022, they produced four different wines spread across 350 cases. Since then, they have grown and are going into their fifth grape harvest, producing 10 to 12 different wines spread across 1,700 cases. We've grown a bit over year by year because we enjoy making wine and we love making wine in Arizona, Ron Oakes said. He added that since they've been able to increase production, it's all still in a pretty artisanal DIY fashion, kind of human power. There's not a lot of fancy machines. Queen of Cup makes low-intervention wine using wild yeast that grows on the grape, filtering the wines only as needed and using sulfite preservatives as minimally as possible. Sulfites can be added to wine by winemakers to preserve the wine's flavor. We're trying to let the vineyard and fruit profile of the grapes kind of shine through, Ron Oakes said. Leaning on sustainability and community. The Queen of Cups also has a wine bottle recycling and sanitation program. People can bring back their empty Queen of Cups wine bottles for a bottle deposit. The used wine bottles are sanitized and then refilled. Each bottle looks the same with the Queen of Cups logo written across the center, but has a different drop tags designed by local artists, depending on the type of wine. It's a way for us to kind of cut down on our footprint a little bit, Christopher said. We've recycled thousands of bottles at this point. The winery also buys grapes primarily from vineyards in southern Arizona and northern Mexico. Their business is growing even as the local wine industry faces challenges. Ron Oakes noted that more established wine-producing regions can take advantage of streamlined processes and labor availability. Wineries in those regions can call a number and someone comes out with a truck to set up a mobile bottling line. This differs from southern Arizona's wine scene, which is made up of small wineries where each business is buying its own equipment and scrambling to find people to help run the bottling lines or other processes. We're not on a scale yet as an industry that allows us to gain certain efficiencies, and those efficiencies eventually, hopefully, will get passed on to the price of a bottle, Ron Oakes said. Despite some of the challenges Arizona's burgeoning wine industry faces, the industry is supportive. And people are doing this fabulous work, this fabulous job of making wine, he said with pride. Ron Oakes and Christopher are continuing to build their winery into a community space where everyone can gather over a glass of wine and small bites of food. They periodically host pop-ups with local chefs and stay open until 10 p.m. on some days, with dim lights, music, and wine, creating a community gathering place in Patagonia. I hope that whoever comes through the doors of the Queen of Cups feels like they can be 1,000% themselves and always feel welcome, Christopher said. And in Arizona State Briefs, a hiker pulls a gun near Prescott. The Yavapai County Sheriff's Office asked for the public's help in identifying a man and woman accused of a violent assault on a hiking trail in Granite Basin near Prescott. About 8:45 a.m., September 6th, a man and woman hiking encountered another pair who had a large brown dog, according to a Facebook post from the sheriff's office. They had a brief conversation about the dog when the man reportedly punched the male hiker multiple times, said the sheriff's office. When the second hiker attempted to intervene, she was attacked by the woman, according to the sheriff's office. The assault ended when the man pulled a small black handgun and pointed it at one of the hikers, the sheriff's office said. They left the area and headed towards the main parking lot, according to the sheriff's office. The hikers suffered minor injuries and declined medical transport, the sheriff's office said. This is from Ren Smetana of the Arizona Republic. Water gun game prompts warning. Goodyear Police issued a warning about the dangers of a game teens are playing with water guns that can be easily mistaken for real weapons. In the game known as Senior Assassin, a high school senior is challenged by someone to eliminate a target by spraying them with a water gun, Goodyear Police said in a Facebook post. Police officers around the country have received reports from concerned citizens related to this game, Goodyear Police said. The department recently became aware of the incident when a vehicle was parked in front of a rideshare vehicle while passengers were getting in, police said. Footage captured by the rideshare's driver's dash camera showed a male teen with a blurred face carrying a water gun similar in appearance to a firearm. The person pointed the gun at a teen passenger in the vehicle, alarming the rideshare driver. Police asked parents to speak to their kids about the very real dangers of the game and reminded the public to always use water guns that are brightly colored and clearly toys. And now in Lifestyles, we have Hints from Eloise. A few necessities for college dorm life. Dear Eloise, when my children went off to college, I sent them off with a fishing tackle box that was filled with these items. A thermometer, Tylenol, Advil, NyQuil, bandages, Neosporin, rubbing alcohol, peroxide, and a timer with a magnetic back to remind them that they had clothes in the washing machine or in the dryer. A sewing kit was also part of the pack. cotton balls and swabs were included as well. My kids are now 36 and 40. My son still has his tackle box and fills it when needed. A friend of mine would give her kids gift cards for Uber and other ride shares. This is from Cindy Wolf via email. Container organization. Dear Eloise, searching for container lids is frustrating. So I have two drawers for food storage containers. One drawer is for the round containers and lids, and the other is for the square containers and lids. Lids are separated from the containers and placed on their edges in a plastic basket at the back of the drawer. To speed up the search, the color of the lid is written with a marker on the bottom with clear containers, blue, green, and red. This is from Cody in North Dakota. A special code. Dear Eloise, regarding the frustration that Susan H. had with determining whether her clothing shoes were blue or black, I used to have the same problem. I worked in retail for 44 years and had a wonderful vendor who told me universal color code for black is always 01 or 001. Every label should have a color code. I hope this helps. It's from Gail in Springfield, Ohio. Learning to read with Eloise. Dear Eloise, just a note to let you know that my dad and I read your column every day when I was growing up. And it's where I learned how to read and sound out words that I didn't know. I was 4 years old back then, and I'm now 34 years old and teaching my own daughter how to read with your column. This is from Diana M. in Kerrville, Texas. Ready, set, rinse. Dear Eloise, I just read your short response concerning whether or not to rinse after brushing one's teeth. My dentist says do not rinse for the same fluoride reason, but I enjoy rinsing. My own solution, which has not been sanctioned by anyone, is to rinse with water after brushing to get the taste out. Then I rinse with a fluoride mouthwash that tastes good and theoretically replaces the fluoride I just rinsed out. It's from Larry G., MD, but not a dentist, in Huntington Beach, California. Disposing of medications. Dear Eloise, always discard of used medications properly to avoid contamination of the ground and waterways. In our city in Alabama, there are many pharmacies that have public disposal containers, and the police department also has one. The discarded medications are covered with a mixture of clumping hardening material and then is handled securely for disposal. This is so important, especially for the prevention of dangerous exposure through the local drinking water for our youth. Check your area, search online, or call City Hall and follow through. Never flush chemicals down a toilet or a drain. Thanks, NH and Old Nurse. Send money or a money-saving and time-saving hint to Heloise at Heloise.com. That's HELOISE.com. And now Royal Stars with Georgia Nichols. Happy birthday for Tuesday, September 9th, 2025. You're inquisitive, nurturing, and innovative. You have a humanitarian ideas. Take inventory of your life this year. Being compassionate and giving will bring rewards. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. Enjoy socializing with others today. Play hooky if you can. Sports events and fun activities with kids will appeal to you. Romance is also favored. However, since many of you are gung-ho to work right now, you probably won't play hooky. Tonight, patience. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. Today, you have a strong sense of personal freedom, which is why you want to get to do what you want to do. Obviously, daily obligations, professional or personal, might restrict this impulse. Tonight, enjoy solitude. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Make an effort to enjoy time with friends today. Likewise, enjoy your interactions with clubs, groups, and organizations, because this will please you. It doesn't have to be super involved. Tonight, be a team player. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. People notice you today, which is something to keep in mind in case you have to do some damage control. In particular, This applies to authority figures, bosses, parents, VIPs, and the police. Tonight, be courteous. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. You have a strong sense of adventure today, which is why travel will appeal to you. Do what you can to feel stimulated by a change in your daily routine. If you can't travel, explore your own city by doing something different. Tonight, avoid controversy. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Financial discussions about inheritances, shared property, or banking details will go well today. With both the Sun and Mercury in your sign, you have an advantage, so why not use it? Tonight, check your finances. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. Physical exercise, gym workouts, long walks, and dancing are some ways to channel some of the energy that might be building up within you because Mars is in your sign. Tonight, genuinely listen. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st. This is a popular time for you, with both friends and organizations to which you might belong. And today, you're happy to put out the emotional considerations of others before your own. Tonight, be accommodating. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. This is a lovely day to travel or do something that's a little different and stimulating. You want to shake up things a bit. A short trip or chance to learn something fascinating will give you pleasure. Tonight, pace yourself. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. Your ambition is strong, and you've been active lately. Today, you might want to pull in your reins and hide at home. Perhaps it will give you pleasure to tweak your digs and make things look more attractive. Tonight, keep the peace. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. This is a great day to schmooze. You feel friendly and have a strong urge to explore, learn new things, and see new places. Travel if you can. This will please you. Discussions about financial matters, including shared property, are likely. Tonight, avoid conflict. And Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Your finances are favored today, which is why you might see ways to boost your earnings. Or you might make a purchase that pleases you. Tonight, check your money. And thank you for tuning in to the Arizona Daily Star for Tuesday, the 9th of September, 2025, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona and read for you by David Grant. Until next time, have a great day.